This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Wednesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. Personal Finance Wednesday, a double dose of it. How to deal with a loved one's estate. How can you handle that well? Also, credit cards versus debit cards. Which one is better financially? Shares of Starbucks are falling after a softer-than-expected forecast for next year. We'll cover that in our next segment. Right now, estimates on China's economy are out, and we're hearing from former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan. We're joined by Diane Swonk, Chief Economist at Grant Thornton here in Chicago. Diane, always good to have you on the show. Let's talk about China's economy first and maybe the impact that might have on this back and forth over trade.
Well, China has got a lot more problems than trade alone, and the Chinese government has already overestimated a lot of their growth and the actual size of their GDP. So we obviously have a hard time trusting them all that much. They did have a good bounce in factory activity in August, which is encouraging. But what's important is China's the second largest economy in the world, and it has been overall slowing. In fact, President Williams of the New York Fed pointed to China today as one of the weak spots in the global economy. And the trade war is just adding insult to injury. Now, we know that there's reasons to be angry with China. The question is the trade war the best way to counter what they're doing? And, you know, there's a lot of debate about that because this is in some ways cutting off our nose to spite our face, because the cost of the trade war will wash up on our own shores.
And when it comes to actually striking a deal, does any weakness or continued weakness in the Chinese economy, is that possibly something that could lead to a deal actually getting done? Seems like both sides have to agree to do something here.
Well, that certainly is, you know, the idea is that both sides have to do something. Remember, China's playing a long game, and I think it's always a little bit premature to assume that they're going to act in a way that we would act necessarily, that, you know, as their economy is suffering, that they would actually act to necessarily get a deal done quicker. And it's not clear what the end game on a deal is yet. The parameters of that are very loose. So even if we get something papered over, they could very rapidly violate it. And I think that's where the concern is for those of us watching it closely, is it's hard for them to come to the table and agree to what we want them to do, because we're on fundamentally different pages. The last mile in trade talks has proven the hardest to traverse, with a lot of landmines scattered throughout it. And I think that's the problems we face right now. The other issue is Hong Kong. You know, one day it looks like things are better today. Hong Kong could be a tipping point if they cannot keep the lid on what's going on in Hong Kong and China infringes on their freedoms more. That could be a tipping point and a straw that breaks the camel's back for China as well.
Let's talk about the former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan saying it's only a matter of time before negative rates spread to the U.S. Give us, for people who aren't familiar with that, maybe a very brief primer on negative interest rates and what happens if Greenspan is right.
Well, you know, it's interesting because many of the largest economies in the world actually have slightly negative interest rates. That doesn't mean that you don't get an interest rate on your deposits in a bank. They've structured things so that doesn't happen. But as a result of it, it has stressed bank balance sheets abroad. It is a way to try to get banks to let people to borrow more, but its effects have been very mixed. It's a very controversial program. And part of what Greenspan's referring to is not only has there been this massive flight to the safety of the U.S. Treasury bond market, which has pushed rates very low, actually negative in places like Germany, where they're issuing debt and being paid to issue debt. That's something very unusual. People are willing to, so worried about the world economy that they're willing to pay Germany for the privilege of parking their money there for a little bit and lending it to them. And that's part of what he's talking about. The other part of this equation is, will the Fed decide that the zero, when they hit zero, that's it? And, you know, during the crisis, they had decided once they got rates down to zero, they wouldn't go any further. That was a line they wouldn't cross. Now they're debating whether they'll cross that line into negative rates. And it really opens up a whole can of worms that of what we worry are unintended consequences. And certainly the banks are not on board on that. That's not the only reason to dislike it. It's that it can cause a lot of other distortions in the broader economy. And what they've proven is every time we've hit negative rates in other economies, we haven't been able to get out of it.
Always good insight from Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton here in Chicago. Thanks for being with us, Diane. Coming up, Starbucks stock is falling on its outlook for next year. We are keeping a close eye on Starbucks today. The stock is down right about 1% after the company updated its forward guidance. To talk about it, we're joined by RJ Hottavy, consumer equity strategist at Morningstar here in Chicago. RJ, what is Starbucks saying about its future?
Yeah, today's pullback is really due to a updated guidance for next year. The company said that next year's EPS would probably not meet its ongoing target of at least 10% growth. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the company benefited from a lower-than-expected tax rate this year, as well as more aggressive buybacks. So it'll be anniversarying some difficult comparisons. But obviously, the timing of this, a lot of chatter about slowing economic concerns, I think is weighing on investors' minds today.
Something else they mentioned is the kiss from the tax cuts. It's only a one-time kiss. Wondering if maybe a lot of companies are going to initially feel that nice feeling, but now they're moving on to more reality.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I think that Starbucks, by being a fiscal year that ends in September, is going to be one of the early companies to report this phenomenon where you're not going to see this continuation of lower tax rates going forward. So I think Starbucks is going to be the first of many to say something similar, where EPS growth into 2020 is not going to be as robust because of the tax benefit that we saw this past year.
Starbucks has had probably one of the most successful apps as far as getting people to be loyal to it. Is there any sign that that might be slowing? I mean, is there a chance that there's just only so far you can go with that among the people that really like your product?
I think, if anything, we've learned that the company's adjusted. They actually hit a soft patch, I'd say, at the beginning of the year in terms of the app. It was slowing down the lines of the restaurants. They weren't connecting with consumers as well. And I think what they've done really the last couple of years, really the last year in particular, is they've really redesigned the stores. And if you go into the stores, anyone that have been remodeled, they're usually kind of trying to decide on one of two consumer need states. One is experience and one is convenience. And those smaller format locations that are all about throughput, they've done a good job better balancing the app and making sure they can get enough people there. I think that's one of the big issues the company struggled with, is that for the longest time this company was all about experience and then opened up the floodgates to this mobile ordering crowd and effectively was trying to serve two audiences at the same time. Very difficult to do, but I think they've been remedying that with a lot of the renovations and the operation improvements they've been making at the store level.
Yeah, even near our studios here, they did a complete redesign of the Starbucks just down the road, and it was because of that logjam with mobile ordering. I mean, the problem with them is it was so successful that people would get off of an L train or a Metro train, and all of a sudden they'd have 50 people there waiting for coffee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really, mobile ordering, in among many other changes in the restaurant industry, delivery, and many others, has really changed. It really is analogous to what we saw in the retail sector about a decade ago when Amazon started to come in and retailers were struggling with what they had to do in terms of, same or next day delivery, mobile ordering, digital ordering. We're seeing a lot of them in the restaurant space, and players like Starbucks have been quick to adapt while others haven't, and I think that's going to lead to a difficult situation for a lot of restaurant operators in the years ahead.
RJ, do you have a recommendation on the stock?
Yeah, even with today's pullback, I think I'd be waiting for even a better entry point. We've got a $90 fair value estimate on that. If we do start to see some macro pressures weighing the stock, it could be worth a better look at that point.
RJ Hottavy, consumer equity strategist at Morningstar here in Chicago. Coming up next, Walmart makes some changes involving firearms and is getting some blowback.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
America's largest retailer is altering its policies involving firearms and ammunition. Let's get an update on Walmart from Matthew Boyle, a reporter at Bloomberg in New York. Matthew, so what exactly is Walmart doing here? What changes are they making?
Yeah, the changes that they're making that they announced yesterday is they're going to discontinue sales of ammunition like .223 caliber and other sizes that can be used in assault-style weapons. They're going to stop selling handguns in Alaska, which is the only state where they still sold them, and they won't offer any sort of handgun ammunition anymore after they get through their current stocks of inventory. And the final thing, and might be the most controversial thing, is that they are going to respectfully request that shoppers refrain from openly carrying firearms in its stores in states where open carry is legal.
And so this, I'm assuming Walmart expects at least a little pushback from some of its customers.
They certainly are, and the CEO was willing to accept that. He said, we know these decisions are going to inconvenience some of our customers, and you know, we hope they understand. But the Walmart CEO Doug McMillon is deciding to, you know, take a stand here in a similar way that he did a few months ago when he said that Congress should raise the minimum wage as well. So Walmart is really starting to take a little bit more of a leadership position here.
And that must, I mean, I'd imagine there's just a lot of pressure on Walmart and other retailers when it comes to this issue. It's no longer something that outside groups are sort of ignoring or taking lightly. There's a lot of people coming after them.
Exactly, including their own employees. There was some employees in Walmart's e-commerce division out in California who were protesting about this, were staging, you know, walkouts and such. So they're seeing it, you know, from their own employees, as well as, of course, the gun control advocacy groups.
Gun makers, I'm assuming that they're at least a little concerned about this, considering Walmart is such a big seller of their products.
Exactly. And ammunition makers, actually, more so, because Walmart only makes up about 2% of gun sales in the country, but they make up about 20% of ammunition sales. And Walmart said yesterday that these moves will reduce their market share in ammunition from 20% to between 6 and 9%. So you did see the share prices of some of the leading ammunition makers in the U.S. fall yesterday.
McMillon, you mentioned that he's been pretty strong about this. Maybe surprising, but he is. Even saying that Congress needs to debate an assault weapons ban, which
goes
beyond just not selling certain things.
Yeah, he said that Congress and the administration need to do their part as well. They need to act. And he sent off letters to congressional leadership yesterday, as well as to the White House, stating just that. So he feels, you know, he has enough clout, enough power as the CEO of the biggest, biggest company in America, and certainly the biggest private employer in America, to be able to see if we can push the needle here.
Thank you, Matthew Boyle, for all the information. Matt is a reporter at Bloomberg based in New York.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Being the executor or manager of a relative's estate can be a daunting task. We'll get help in Personal Finance Wednesday. Also on the financial front, reasons why paying with a credit card may be preferable to debiting a purchase. A 34-year-old woman from Indiana is accused of killing her 10-year-old stepdaughter. The National Weather Service is investigating whether it was a tornado that caused damage in the far northern suburbs last night. On Wall Street, the Dow up 212 points, NASDAQ up 94, the S&P up 27, and oil is up more than 4.5%. We have some clouds in Chicagoland, but also some sunshine. It'll be a mixture throughout the day as we head to a high of 72 degrees. Right now, 68 O'Hare, 69 Midway, and 68 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. Markets are gaining ground today. Let's find out what's going on. Paul Nolte is joining us, portfolio manager at Kingsview Asset Management here in Chicago. Paul, what do you make of the rise today?
Good afternoon. It is the exact mirror opposite of yesterday. We were worried about trade. We put on some tariffs over the weekend. China threatened to retaliate. Today, Hong Kong has backed off at least some of the extradition parts of their agreement with China. That eased. Brexit looks to be put off a little bit. China's economic numbers were a little bit better than expected. So everything is fine. What were we worried about yesterday?
And isn't that so funny? That, I mean, we're literally at the point where maybe minute to minute, but at least day by day, you just don't know what news event or soundbite is going to move the markets.
No, and that's just it. Each day we've wiped the slate clean. We start brand new, and there's really nothing that carries over from the prior day. So if we get some talk about trade or that we're going to meet or we're meeting to meet or we're going to ramp up the tariffs, the markets react pretty violently to that. And we've saw it all through the month of August. So we're still in that trading range that we've had through August. We're still there, but it's 1 to 2% moves each day, bouncing around from bottom to top.
So what advice do you give investors then in an environment with that sort of volatility where you just don't know where things are going to go?
You really want to stick to your knitting and try not to get swayed by the daily moves, because it will give you a headache and or premature gray. So stick with what you're comfortable with as far as an overall allocation to stocks. Realize that we're really only down about 5, maybe 7% from the all-time highs. Interest rates have come down, so that has been a good part of a portfolio type of return as well. So when you look at the big picture of for the month of August, we're down a little bit, but it's not anything that's to the end of the world here. But we still want to pay attention to the overall economic picture. But I don't think it's warranting scaring people out of stocks at this point.
You mentioned that we're not really all that far off from the high. Does that make finding bargains tougher in an environment like that where we're pretty close to the top?
You know, it can, but here's the interesting part of the market is it has been very much a growth market. So when you look at large cap growth stocks, the technology, et cetera, they've had tremendous runs. But you look at other parts of the market, small cap, international, emerging markets, value here in the United States, they've lagged dramatically. And there are a lot of opportunities outside of the very large U.S. companies. And that spread has kind of gotten wider as we've gone through the course of the year. So if you're willing to do a little bit of work, you can find some bargains, but you're going to have to be patient until the markets decide that this is a good part of the market to go fishing in. Right now, they're very happy in the very large U.S. companies.
And is it maybe in a season like this easier just to go for some good dividends if you're maybe unwilling or unable to do the work to really find some of those nuggets?
You know, the dividend stocks, some of them are pretty fairly valued. So the utilities are pretty expensive at this point. There's some of the consumer staples, which are another go-to. There are some that are pretty cheap there. Energy is actually very cheap, and it has suffered and done very poorly this year. But a lot of the oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, et cetera, support some very nice dividends. But again, that one is an out-of-favor sector, one that's going to require patience for energy to maybe turn around here a little bit.
So you have Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chair, saying negative interest rates will likely spread to the U.S. as it's only a matter of time. That has to be something. He's not the first person to sort of wonder about that, but that has to make Wall Street at least a little concerned.
Especially in the financials and the banking sector, because it's a huge problem for them to generate revenue, generate earnings when your spreads are negative. I don't know what that impact is going to be here in the United States. It certainly hasn't been a benefit to those countries that have had negative interest rates, Germany for a while, Japan for more than just a few years. It has not spurred that economic growth. So it has to be matched up with good fiscal policy in order to try to get the economy going. My fear is it will continue to spur on additional lending, additional debt, and it's not necessarily productive from a long-term perspective.
And does it just show, I mean, there are limits to what you can do to manipulate the economy and guide the markets. I mean, at some point, it's the market that has to figure this stuff out.
It is, but when you take a look at Japan as again, a long-term example of that, their central bank has actually gone to start to buy stocks within Japan. So they've extended beyond just bonds, government bonds. They've bought corporate bonds. That's been true in Europe. So they've expanded what they're willing to buy. And so from that perspective, we're very much in a new era of central bank intervention in the markets. So the markets, I think, are still very beholden to what central banks are willing to do in the marketplace under the guise of trying to get the economy going or trying to get inflation higher than what it is.
Really interesting stuff. Thanks for the analysis. Paul Nolte, portfolio manager at Kingsview Asset Management here in Chicago.
Money Talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday here on the Noon Business Hour. This afternoon, we're getting assistance in dealing with a loved one's estate. Lending a hand is Craig Bolanos, founding partner and chief executive officer at Wealth Management Group in Inverness and Downers Grove. Craig, before we find out maybe some of the things that need to be done or can be done to make it easier, just talk about the magnitude of the task, because I think a lot of people agree to be executor of someone's estate and they just have no idea what's involved in that.
Oh, I think it's absolutely overwhelming. I mean, you know, you lose a loved one and that focus is all on family. It's going through the grieving process. It's supporting one another. And, you know, you volunteer or you're named, appointed to be that executor. And depending on how complicated or how simple the decedent's finances are, this could be a heavy lift, or it could be something that you can do in a relatively streamlined process. But it all starts with just trying to determine if whether or not a will or a trust even exists in the first place.
So in general, if someone agrees, hey, all right, I'll be the executor of your estate, what are they agreeing to? What are some of the things they're going to have to do?
Well, I mean, one, you have this utmost responsibility to the person who passed away to ensure that all of their wishes are respected. And when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, a lot of it has to do with what? It has to do with money. So that executor is going to need to notify all the creditors that are out there. That executor is going to have to create an inventory of the debts, all of the assets. And most importantly, that executor has to have tremendous, frequent, regular communication with all of the interested parties in the estate, because when you don't have communication, it leads to litigation, and above all else, we got to make sure that's avoided.
Is there a way for someone to figure out when they're thrown into that situation whether they can handle it or whether they need to bring in a professional?
You know what? What I'm going to say is this. I think there's an awful lot of things in finance that we can do oneself. We can go it alone. But when it comes to estate administration, I'm going to default every day of the week that people should be bringing in a professional. And for this reason, too. If you just lost a loved one, I don't care how well-versed you are in finance, you're dealing with the emotional dynamics of money. And when you can bring in an independent third party that can help see everything clearly and cut to the chase, I think it's just going to put everybody on a better path to success. So, no, you should absolutely hire for talent. Don't go it alone when it comes to settling an estate.
Seems like the magnitude of the task differs depending upon the size of the estate, right? How much money the person has when they die?
You know what? I'm going to say I don't know how much it has to do with money. Now, certainly if someone is very wealthy, has complicated business interests, there's estate, death, and transfer taxes that are due, that's one thing. But I think it actually has to do more with how well organized the decedent's finances are. I mean, if everything comes down to having a home, having a banking relationship, and having an investment relationship, that might be relatively easy. But when money is spread across multiple banks, multiple properties, multiple brokerage firms, all of a sudden it's a much heavier lift. So I think the key for everybody is if you have people that are counting on you, you have those that you love, you owe it to them while you're here, while you're in good shape, to organize your finances in a streamlined manner to make the settlement process that much easier in the future.
Thanks so much, Craig Bolanos, founding partner and chief executive officer at Wealth Management Group in Inverness and Downers Grove. This time tomorrow, Technology Thursday. Still to come, part two of Personal Finance Wednesday, the credit card versus debit card debate.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Using a debit card may not necessarily be the most financially savvy way to pay for things. We welcome Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com, based in New York. Ted, for years we've heard use debit versus credit because then the money's coming right out of your account and you're not going to risk any sort of interest or that sort of thing. It's not necessarily the best course of action, though.
There are two main things to think about here. One of them is rewards. The other one is security. So starting on the reward side of things, credit cards have way better rewards than debit cards, but these credit card rewards programs are only worth it if you're paying your bills in full. So if you're carrying a credit card balance, then that changes the equation dramatically. Then you might be better off with cash or debit and sacrificing rewards. You don't want to pay those high credit card interest rates.
And as you say, the rewards are only good if you're not paying the interest, because then it sort of eats up the rewards.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you can pay your bills in full, I really like credit cards. I also like credit cards from a security standpoint, because if your credit card gets hacked, that's just a line of credit. It's easy to get that money restored. It's not real money missing from your account. If your debit card gets hacked, that's a direct link to your checking account. So even if you get it back, it could take a week or two, sometimes even more. That's a big no-no for debit cards.
Seems like it's easier if there is some sort of a problem with a purchase, if you have a credit card. It's easier because the money's not already out of the bank account.
It's a similar premise to security. It does go a little bit further because credit card companies are usually very generous with things like purchase protection, extended warranties, guaranteed returns. A lot of times your credit card company is going to be more generous than the merchant. So if you have some problem with the item, you might be able to get a refund or even just ship it to the credit card company and they'll take it off your hands and refund you the money. So your dispute protection is usually better with a credit card.
That seems like that would give you some leverage with the merchant as well, because you could tell them, hey, I'm just going to call the credit card company if you don't fix this.
Exactly. Credit card companies have a lot of leverage, and we can use that to our benefit as consumers. Merchants hate these chargebacks, as they're called. You know, they really try to avoid that, but it's something that you can definitely use to your advantage if you have some sort of dispute, if the item's broken or it never showed up or you weren't satisfied with your service. You don't want to abuse this, but a lot of times if you contact your credit card company, they're going to be very generous taking it off your bill, and then they're going to go chase the merchant down.
Really interesting. Thank you, Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com. If you missed any part of today's Noon Business Hour, the replay podcast will be available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the radio.com app.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.